It's 9:06, and this is special election coverage on IPR News Radio. Good morning. I'm David Castleman, and it's great to have you with us this morning. Today we have Lon Johnson in the studio. He is the Democrat running for U.S. Congress in Northern Michigan, and we're going to chat for an hour about Social Security, about veterans benefits, about Line 5, and much more. But before we get to all those issues, Lon, we do want to know a little bit more about Lon Johnson. But first, let me say thanks for coming on today.
Thanks for having me. Thank you, David.
So I think for many people in Northern Michigan, you probably first came out of their radar in 2012 when you ran for a state house seat in Northern Michigan, the 103rd. What were you doing before then?
Well, I grew up the same way that everyone here does, and that's with the raised by family to work hard and to play by the rules and to never give up. Those values saw me through a life of work. I was one of the first in my family to graduate from college. I was in Iraq as a civilian. excuse me, in 2005, came home in '06 to Kalkaska, married my wife in Northport. Worked for a number of years investing in U.S. Manufacturing businesses. And those values now I'm taking to Congress. I was also chairman of the Michigan Democratic Party
right.
in 2013 through 2015.
And we'll talk about all those issues as we or all those events as we go along. Your dad was a machinist.
He was.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Where
mm-hmm.
did he work?
Well, my dad worked. I grew up just south of Detroit, moved back here in 06. My dad moved here in 86 and was a machinist in this area for quite some time. So my dad was a machinist. My mother was a nurse's physician's assistant. And so we grew up, neither of my parents went to college, but they were able to make a decent living and do well.
Mm-hmm. And was your dad working somehow in the auto industry? I mean, was he?
No, actually, he was a machinist. He worked a CNC lathe. Worked a lathe and then a CNC later, a CNC lathe. And much of his work actually was during the 80s, as the auto industry started to slump. My dad, because of the defense buildup, actually did well as a machinist making various military parts. I distinctly remember my dad telling me that.
Mm-hmm. And what was your relationship with Northern Michigan growing up?
Well, growing up, this was a place that we always came to. I knew, my family had, on both sides of my family, had lived in Northern Michigan since around the turn of the century, late 1800s. They came here as loggers. But it wasn't a place that I grew up. My dad moved back here in 86 or 87. He was 35, and then I moved back here in 2006, and it just dawned on me the other day. I came back at the same time that my dad came back at 35.
Mm-hmm. And you were 35 when you moved back.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And I understand. I've heard from many people that you are you're a hunter and a fisherman. Was that something that you grew up with?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I grew up deer hunting. Grouse hunting, in the woods. It's why I live where I live, frankly.
When did you get your first deer?
My first buck was not until I was in my 30s. My first buck.
Mm-hmm.
It was a beautiful sight. It was November of 6 when I had a nice buck walk in. It was a 9-point. Not even about a half mile from my home.
Mm-hmm. So that was, and your place is between Kalkaska and Grayling?
Correct. It's between Frederick and Kalkaska, right off 612. If anyone's familiar with that area, it's right off the Manistee River near the Cameron Bridge. Any fly fisherman will tell you where I live. I live off the Cameron Bridge Road.
Right, right.
The Cameron Bridge and at Osama River, at the Manistee River.
So I want to talk about a couple of some of the life experiences that you brought up earlier. excuse me. You spent time working for an NGO in Iraq during the Iraq War.
Mm-hmm.
When were you there, and what kind of work did you actually do?
It was a program created by Ronald Reagan in the 80s, funded by the National Endowment for Democracy. Essentially what it was when countries fall, When a dictatorship falls or a communist country falls, or you have some sort of natural, you know, disaster of some sort, where you have a vacuum, we need to quickly create the infrastructure of democracy. You have a moment in time to build the infrastructure, the building blocks of democracy, a government, media, social service agencies like, you know, Kiwanis and chambers of commerce, and also a political infrastructure. And this program funded this organization, National Democratic Institute. It was funded by the U.S. Congress to build those infrastructures within Iraq.
And what years were you there?
July of 2005. I landed and came home in late January, early February of 2006. I went there and was asked to help build the work on the constitutional election and then subsequently the parliamentary election of 2005. So we were there working with the tribal leaders and so forth to build a political infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. And where actually were you?
I was in downtown Baghdad, a neighborhood called Karada, for about a month. And then from there on, I was down in Hilla, about 50 miles south of Baghdad. You know, we didn't live in the green zone. We didn't live in an army base. We didn't live at an embassy. Frankly, we had to live where the Iraqis could come and sit down with us without fear of being assassinated, to be honest. And so I lived in these communities and met and worked with the Iraqi leadership there.
When you came back, is that when you started working for the private equity firm in Tennessee?
I had worked for them previously on a few small projects, but then became very engaged when I returned home. And they allowed me to do that from Kalkaska, which was one of the benefits. You know, it was what we did was we bought first or second generation manufacturing companies. You know, oftentimes people will grow a business from, say, in their garage to a quarter million, maybe up to 10 or 20 million or even 40 or 50 million. The problem is from that point, when you're that size, oftentimes the only people that want to buy you are your competitors who want to move you, want to merge you. And so what we did was we would buy these companies off the owners and keep the management team in place and continue them on the growth. We didn't move them. We didn't merge them.
Can you think of a company that you guys worked with that took off?
Oh yeah, we had a chicken plant, chicken processing plant. We had a sausage company. We had a mixing company. They made industrial mixers. There's oftentimes again, these are terrific companies all throughout America. That are in smaller towns, and the owner wants to retire, but he or she does not want to sell that company off to someone who's going to move them and merge them. And so, you know, we would buy these companies give a piece of the ownership to the current existing management so that they're incentivized to stay and incentivized to continue growing the company along with us.
Are you still involved with that company right now?
I'm not. I have a small piece of a partnership. The way that it works, it was called funds. And so we would raise a pool of money, invest it, and then exit. I'm still partner in the second fund. They're now on to a third and maybe even a fourth. I don't know. But I'm a small partner in on the second fund.
And when you ran to become the chair of the Michigan Democratic Party, that was in early 2013, correct?
Correct. I just got off the campaign trail of 2012. I nearly lost in Kalkaska there in the 103rd district.
Mm-hmm. And what made you want to go from a side of trying to elect yourself to a job where you're trying to get others elected? What made you?
This has never been about me. You know, I got involved in politics because I cared about the issues. I think if you would have Googled me before I ran for office, I would have showed up maybe twice, and that was probably because of my wife. It's my life has always been, I've always cared about making a difference. Very early on, I was very fortunate to see how one person can make a difference and in a political campaign.
And how did you see that?
I went to work. my freshman year in college, I had a professor who gave us a great assignment, and that was you have to write about something you'd like to do but knew you never would. And I picked campaign manager. I was a fine arts major. And then we had to go interview whatever we picked, and I interviewed a campaign manager, and they ultimately went on to bring me on board to the campaign in a big way. And I was shocked that here I was at 19 years old, 20 maybe, and I was making a difference. We won.
Were you a painter? You said you were a fine arts major. I'd never heard
photography.
That. Photography.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I went out to Arizona State. I went out west. At 18, you think you're going to be the next Ansel Adams, you know. but I went out west, and I went to school at Arizona State.
Mm-hmm. And when you look over that couple years with the Michigan Democratic Party, those were tough times for Democrats in this state. What do you see as your accomplishments from that time?
You know, as I saw my opening the party, politics is the art of addition. It's about bringing more people to the table, diversifying your candidates, diversifying your volunteer base, diversifying your fundraising base, diversifying your message. Politics, if you are not growing, if you're not bringing new people to the table, you will lose. You're not being representative, and you have to always bring new people to the table. And for too many years, I saw the Democratic Party not doing that. And I and others thought that we could do a better job. And I'm proud to say that I believe we did that.
Quickly, and then I want to get on to the issues themselves. When you look back, what's the single most important thing that you see that's, or let me rephrase that. What have you done that you think has best prepared you to lead this district if you had to pick one experience?
I think it's the values that I was raised with. You know, this district is very diverse geographically, but what unites us is being from the North is our resiliency, our innovation, and our love of the land and the water. And coming from that generation after generation, having that passed on to me is a shared value that I believe it must be there when you seek to represent people. People know that. They see it in you, and you see it in them. And, having that shared value is really important.
You were listening to special election coverage on IPR News Radio. I'm David Castleman, and this is a live hour with Lon Johnson, the Democrat running for U.S. Congress in the 1st Congressional District. You can join us by calling in with a question at 800-681-5929. That's 800-681-5929. And we will have the all the other candidates on for call-in shows as the month goes on. I want to talk about some old business briefly. We had a candidate forum last night, and you went after your opponent Jack Bergman, the Republican in the race, on a number of issues, including Social Security. At the end of the forum, the Libertarian Diane Bostow, she kind of chastised you and said that she felt disrespected that you were ignoring her. I wanted to give you a chance to respond because you didn't have that last night.
You know, that I ignored her. I mean, here I am being, you know, look, my argument here largely is, I need to make the case of why I should be hired to be your next member of Congress. When you look there, I really don't have a response to that. I mean, if she was mad that I didn't, point out greater differences between her and I apologize.
Let's talk about some specific policies, and let's start with Social Security, which is one that Republicans and Democrats are both talking about right now. And you've made it a big part of what you're campaigning on. The Congressional Budget Office says that Social Security's trust fund is going to be exhausted by 2029. How do we keep Social Security solvent?
First off, it won't be exhausted. It'll diminish. It'll start paying less out than it should. Than what you've come to, what the guarantee was. But that's still problematic. Mm-hmm. It's a problem. I think we have to address that problem. the first thing here, though, you know, people have Social Security is a promise that needs to be kept. It's been there through wars, through, you know, recessions, through stock market plunges. It is something that's important. It's a promise that needs to be kept. Okay, so now how do we keep that promise? Well, number one, I don't believe that it should be sent off to Wall Street and privatized. We can keep that promise and make sure Social Security is kept solvent by one very simple, direct way, and that is when you and I, people no longer pay into the Social Security system after they make $118,500. They stop having to pay into
right.
that. So somebody making $250,000 stops paying at $118,500. Mm-hmm. Somebody, you know, who makes less than that continues to pay. But yet that person making, say, $250,000 still receives the benefit. If you lift that cap, you can make sure that Social Security remains solvent for the next 50 years.
But I guess the question is, do they get the benefit for that additional money? And I think I thought the answer was no on that, on whether, you know, although there's a tax cap, a tax max at mm-hmm. $118,000, and it's adjusted.
Mm-hmm.
Explain a little further about why that's a good deal, because that's been part of Social Security from the beginning.
We did it for Medicare as well. You know, back in the 90s, they lifted the cap off on Medicare and you continued to pay, and that made sure that Medicare was solvent, and Medicare's turned out to be one of the best programs this country's ever had. The bottom line is the philosophical and the real difference here is that I just don't believe that you paid into that system. You earn that benefit, and I don't believe to hand that off to Wall Street, they're salivating to get a hold of that. There's billions of dollars in fees and commissions at stake here. Social Security needs to be made solvent. I'm not diminishing the real threat that we have here, but there are ways to solve that without handing it over to Wall Street. And the primary way is to make sure that everyone who's receiving Social Security pays into it.
Let's go. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Dave on line one. He has a question about school funding issues. Dave, hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks for having me. Thank you, Mr. Johnson, for being on today.
What's your question?
Yeah, I'm a school teacher. I'm a school teacher in Traverse City, and I just went through two different schools in the last 3 years for my kids. One. Primarily because Interlochen Elementary School closed and this sort of TCAP sort of shrinking and downsizing. And a lot of what the superintendent has said is that we have an unfair playing field in the state of Michigan, that because school funding for districts is based partly on census and how many students are in a school district, and then partly on, to tell you the truth, I can't really understand the calculus about how this is decided.
It's complicated.
It seems that... Yeah, it seems that TCAPS has been getting the short end, and so the TCAPS keeps going around wearing as this badge of courage. Well, we're underfunded, but we're high performing, and who loses out on that? Well, schools get closed.
Right.
The resources for for teachers and students seems to really be just flatlining. And I'm just curious about what a congressperson can do in this kind of situation.
Thanks for your question, Dave. So, Lon, what can the Congress at the federal level do to stabilize school funding at the state level?
Well, at the state level, as he pointed out, much of the school funding is decided at the state level. However, there are a number of things that Congress does, and the Department of Education does do. We rely in this. We have over 100 school districts in the first congressional district who rely on primarily two funding sources from the Department of Education. One is Title I funding, which goes to districts that have disadvantaged students.
Right.
To make sure that those disadvantaged students are, children below the poverty line or with special needs are being, this program's being funded. Title I funding is a very important funding source, revenue stream for many of our districts. So first off, making sure Title I is fully funded. Number two, it's IDEA program. It's essentially a program for special needs students. Oftentimes, many of our districts need additional assistance to make sure that the special needs students' needs are addressed. So those two funding streams are important. The bottom line, though, I believe in public education. What's happening in America and in Michigan in particular, you're seeing funding being reduced to our public schools. And that translates to more crowded classrooms, less extracurricular activities, lower teacher retention. And then what's happening, this is being done, frankly, I believe by design, to push families into for-profit and charter options. And look, those I don't believe in for-profit enterprise for education. I believe that we have to invest in public education. That's a big difference between my opponent and I.
And let me remind you that you can call in with your question for Lon Johnson at 800-681-5929. That's 800-681-5929. I want to talk about another...
My opponent and me, by the way. We're on education.
I want to talk about another education issue.
Yeah.
I've heard you say that... you know, you thought that people who have student loan debt, mm-hmm. So students and people who are out of school, should be able to refinance their loans from the federal government. Can you expand on that?
Sure. You know, look, again, as the state and the federal government reduces their assistance to our public universities, that cost is being then shifted down to our students. And students are having to take, you know, as that tuition goes up, there's only so many Pell Grants and other scholarships available. Students are having to increase their debt load. That's a fact. And we have to, beyond addressing, you know, the state and federal funding to our universities, the immediate effect is students are graduating with an enormous amount of debt, and we need to give them the ability to refinance. You can refinance your car debt. You can refinance your credit card. You can refinance your home. We should be giving these students the ability to refinance their loan. But we have to get to also the underlying reasons why are they taking on so much debt. We need to make sure that students are getting the assistance and these universities are getting the assistance. This is an investment. This isn't some giveaway program.
Bringing assistance levels or will increasing funding for universities make up that difference? Because it seems like the cost of college has far outpaced inflation, mm-hmm. and even the decreases in funding that have happened, especially at the state level.
Well, if we were to increase funding from either the state or from the federal government, we need to make sure that goes directly into tuition relief. Not into some research project or, you know, some new faculty lounge or some new stadium, frankly. We have to make sure. Look, the difference is very clear between my opponent and me on this issue. I believe that college education is an investment. It is something that as a society we are better off when we have people with education, whether it's a trade school or community college or a four-year university. And our budget should properly reflect that. Now, we did that with the GI Bill. You know, there's no coincidence why we had the most productive time in our nation's history from 1950 to 1980 is because we saw all these motivated young people coming out of the service, these men and women who had sacrificed, you know, 4 years or 5 years or many more of their lives. We made sure that they were properly educated when they came out, and they changed the world.
All right, let's move on. Let's go to Barb in Leelanau County. She has a question about climate change. Barb, you're on the air. What's your question?
Thanks. I wanted to ask, Lon, since I know you want to address climate change, will you try to limit carbon emissions by putting a price on carbon in some way?
I have a hard time. No. The answer is no. We need to address climate change. It's real. I believe in science. But however, we have to do this in such a way that it does not harm and massively disrupt our economy. This can be done. We can work together to find that solution with, you know, renewable energy, greater energy efficiency. There are ways to do this with business, and there are ways to just to dictate. And I don't believe in dictating to our economy. If we're going to solve this crisis, everyone has to be at the table, and we have to come up with a solution that everyone agrees with. There's going to be no silver bullet here. It's going to be a series of solutions, and where we can't find, we've got to be able, as we move forward, we've got to find common agreement. And when we don't find that, like on this carbon tax, I don't believe we should be moving forward with it.
Do you think that you're going to be able to find common agreement on climate change if you know, if you're elected to Congress?
Yeah, you know, look, there's, you start small, you know, you start with where do we agree? Where are we both trying to get to? This doesn't always have to be pistols at dawn, you know. It can be renewable energy is a prime example. You know, we need affordable power here. We need reliable power here. We need power that doesn't pollute our air or our water. Now, renewable energy can be that answer. What's the 20-year, 30-year plan to move us off that direction? 20 or 30 years right around the corner. And if we start now, how do we find the investors to bring that money here? How do we find, make sure that we have the regulations to allow it? And then how do we find the customer base that agrees to it? You start now, and in 20 and 30 years' time, you will ultimately be, you know, have a significant impact upon our climate.
Let's take a short break. We'll come back in a couple minutes. Back to your calls. Once again, the number to call in to ask Democratic congressional candidate Lon Johnson a question is 800-681-5929. Stick around. We'll be back in a couple minutes. This is IPR News Radio.
Good morning. You're listening to Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Morgan Springer. This hour, we're bringing you special election coverage, a live call-in show with Lon Johnson, the Democratic nominee in the U.S. 1st Congressional race. You'll hear from the other candidates later this month. If you'd like to join the conversation today, give us a call with your question for Lon Johnson after the break. The number is 800-681-5929. In your weather forecast for the region today, mostly cloudy with highs in the mid-60s. Tomorrow, rain is likely with highs in the 60s. Then on Thursday, partly sunny skies, highs in the low 50s. On Friday, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 50s. This is IPR News Radio.
It's 9:33, and you're listening to special election coverage on IPR News Radio and a live call-in hour with Democratic congressional candidate Lon Johnson. We're going to get back to the calls right now. Let's go to Max from Kingsley on line two. He has a question about campaign finance. Max, you're on the air. What's your question?
Hi. I wanted to ask Lon, with the majority of the Democratic constituency here in Northern Michigan voting for Bernie Sanders, what would Lon do for campaign finance reform at the national level, specifically regarding Citizens United?
It's a great question. We have to rid our nation of Citizens United. It is a horrible decision. So just a quick education. Citizens United was a Supreme Court decision that allowed corporations the right of free speech, and the right of free speech in the form of political contributions of unlimited to these independent expenditures. It is allowing billions of dollars to be poured into this political process, and I think it's driving our country towards an oligarchy and needs to be overturned.
And it was a Supreme Court decision. So in some way, it matters a lot who's elected president.
Absolutely. It always matters who's elected president or your senators. The pick of the Supreme Court is extremely important. Here's a prime example. Citizens United needs to be overturned, and we need to get that done either at the federal level or at the state level, but it needs to get done.
Can you do anything from Congress?
Well, there's a number of things that we can do. First off, just moral leadership as a member of Congress. There are a number of pieces of legislation that we can allow for greater sunlight, greater education. But yes, we can start to, Congress can vote to overturn that, and we should.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's hear from Jim from Interlaken. He has a question about VA benefits. Jim, you're on the air. What's your question for Lon Johnson?
Yes, Mr. Johnson. I'm a disabled veteran, and at this point, we have a long trip to Saginaw if we have to have anything done more than just having a blood test drawn there. I'm not in favor of turning it over to private services, and I was just wondering what can we do so we don't have to travel 300 miles or 500-mile round trips down to either Saginaw, Ann Arbor, or Detroit. This puts a financial burden on the veterans. So
sure. Could you stay on the line? I just want to ask you a question. I presume, sure. What's your experience with Veterans Choice? Because what I'm hearing horrible things there.
And let's just explain the choice program is it's a stopgap, or it's a measure that was put in place to give veterans the ability to get more private care and have it paid for by the VA if they meet certain qualifications, like they live far away. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, well, so I had to have an MRI, and I was scheduled to go to Ann Arbor, but I couldn't do it in Ann Arbor, so I ended up with a CT scan in Saginaw. And so it seems to me that these sort of things should be turned over to someone up here in the Grand Traverse County area or in northern Michigan rather than having to travel so far. Frankly, my other experiences with the VA have been pretty good. But I really don't want to have to travel that long to have, specialized services like having an echocardiogram or something that.
Well, there's been a program out there that allows veterans who cannot, travel, or the wait time is too excessive to go to a private facility and use their VA benefits at that private facility. From what I'm hearing, that program, in concept, the program, veterans like that concept. However, in implementation, that it's not being run well at all. And in fact,
Yes.
So we have to. So first off, we've got real problems. We need to reform that process. We need to hold those people accountable to make sure it gets done. But the biggest difference here is that I don't believe in privatizing our VA. The DAV, the American Legion, the VFW, every major veterans organization has come out opposed to it. But that's not to say that what we have right now is working.
But Lon, do you support expanding a program like the Choice Act that does give veterans more opportunity to have the VA pay for health care in the community, for them to get health care in the community?
Well, we have 12 different VA facilities here. I believe that we need to make sure that this Veterans Choice Program is up and running and running properly. And right now, from every veteran that I talk to, they're not happy that it is. They don't feel that it's being run properly.
And one of the main issues that I picked up on is that veterans often, while they might be able to get a physical, in Traverse City, if like Jim, they have to get an MRI, they often have to travel to Saginaw or beyond.
Mm-hmm.
So can you just clarify further? Do you think that philosophically, that we should pay, that the federal government and the VA system should pay for veterans to get health care from, at Munson?
Again, yeah, if it meets that criteria, if it's out of there, I think it's a 30 or 40 mile, if it's out of their radius and they cannot, or if the wait time within that radius is too long, they should have options. Absolutely. Yes. Look, we cannot delay the care that we owe these veterans, and that does need to be addressed. But the answer isn't to shut down our VA facilities and hand it all over to a private entity. I will remind you that the Veteran Choice Program that everyone is really upset about is being run because it's being run by a court. It's run by being run by a private corporation, not by the VA. We've got to address.
That's a contractor who's yeah. administering it.
Yeah. We saw what happened in the Grand Rapids VA when that went over to a private contractor. They had all sorts of abuses. We need, I'm not here to tell you that the VA does not need to be reformed. It does. Without a doubt, these wait times and accessibility are real issues, and they're costing people, and we need to hold the VA accountable. But privatization and interjecting a corporation in between a veteran and his services or her services, not the answer.
We have a question about the Second Amendment. Let's go to Frank from Petoskey. Frank, you are on the air. What is your question?
Yes. Hi, Lon, and thanks for running. Isn't it possible to be a hunter and defender of Second Amendment rights, yet still support the kinds of common sense gun purchase and gun regulations as proposed by the president?
Well, I think that we have, you know, someone, whether you carried a weapon or a gun in the war or for sport or for self-protection, with that you carry a sense of responsibility. That is a sense that that responsibility we have here in Northern Michigan, we have in the Upper Peninsula. There are a number of things that we can agree to that we need to be addressing. Federal prosecution of gun crimes. That's down 40%. If you commit a crime with a gun, you need to be put away. You've broken a society a boundary, and that needs to be addressed and forcefully. You know, this woman that was shot in Chicago this gentleman was on his second felony with a firearm. You know, that's just ridiculous. You commit a crime with a gun, you need to be put away. We need greater funding to make sure that we enforce the rules that we have. Second, we need to increase our mental health funding. This is not just, you know, we have a, you know, our federal, both at the federal and state level, we have been reducing funding towards mental health. It is not only a tragedy for the individual who's not being able to live up to their God-given potential. However, the consequences, though, to our society, when that individual gets a hold of a gun, is bad. We've got to address mental health funding in this country.
If Hillary Clinton is elected, one of the things she wants to do is expand background checks for guns, and to close the so-called gun show loophole, where you can buy a gun at a gun show and not have the same background checks that you might have otherwise if you went to a gun shop. Would you support that?
Well, I think, what we need, I don't believe that limiting our Second Amendment rights is the answer here. I just want to keep coming back to what we can agree on. What we can agree on is that we need to prosecute these, we need to increase our funding and prosecute gun crimes, and we need to increase mental health.
So to clarify, you wouldn't support Hillary Clinton's call to close the gun hole loophole? So-called gun show loophole.
I think that, you know, private purchases between two owners, I believe, don't pose the risk that that individuals are portraying it to be. We believe, you know, I believe in the Second Amendment. I don't believe the answer here is to limit our Second Amendment rights. I believe that we should be focusing on what we can agree on, and that's increasing federal prosecution of gun crimes and making sure mental health is funded.
You're listening to special election coverage on IPR News Radio. You can call in with your question for Lon Johnson, who is running for Congress here in Northern Michigan. The number to call in is 800-681-5929. That's 800-681-5929. Let's go to another caller. Let's hear. Let's go to Fred from Alberta on line four. You have a question about prisons. Fred, you're on the air. What's your question?
Hey, good morning. Great debate last night. I felt as though, Lon, you talked about education when you were asked about what you would do about the prison population, and we are in the midst of a incarceration epidemic. But coming off your last question, 48%, this is according to the DOJ report in 2013, 48% of all federal inmates are in for nonviolent drug crimes. What are your positions on decriminalization of drugs, and what can we do in the meantime? I agree education is the way for the future, but what are we going to do about our prison population right now? It's so bloated. It's taxing our society. It's taxing our budgets. I mean, Michigan, the general fund, a fifth of it every year is spent on just corrections. It doesn't even include the police budget. So I guess that would be my question.
You know, I would tend to focus on intervention before they go to prison, or how do we stop the prison population from increasing. We do that by making sure that we invest in people, making sure that we have a well-funded education system. We make sure that we have intervention programs when we see a 13-year-old or a 15-year-old starting to get in trouble with drugs or alcohol. We need to invest in our young people, and we also need to address this opiate problem that we're having. We're seeing an explosion. You talk to any prosecutor, any judge, any sheriff here. You know, we have people that have worked their entire life in very tough jobs, outdoor, you know, logging, mining, military. These are jobs that are hard on somebody's body, and they hit 50, 55 years old. Their elbow goes out, their shoulder goes out, their knee goes out. They go to a doctor. They're prescribed an opiate for pain, and before you know it, they're addicted. And that once those pills run out, they're seeking to relieve that pain or their addiction in another form, heroin or whatever sort of street opiate they can get. And we're seeing that has to be addressed immediately. It's becoming an epidemic. And we have to all have find alternative ways. You know, I read the state police has got a terrific program, you know, a couple programs that they're trying out now. And it was an interesting quote. He said, "We're not going to arrest our way out of this problem." And we have to address this opiate problem. We are not going to arrest our way out of it. We've got to get to the and we've got to intervene earlier and make sure that an addiction is treated. And before it causes too much pain for that person, their family, or our society.
I want to switch gears a bit and talk about an environmental issue. You've called for shutting down Line 5. That's the oil pipeline that goes across the Straits of Mackinac. It's the one that Enbridge operates. They say that it's safe, that it's in pristine condition. Many environmental groups and citizen groups are worried about it. They say it's too old. It's over 60 years old. I'm wondering... if you're elected, you're going to be a freshman congressman. How are you going to get anywhere in Congress on this issue if you're elected? How do you get anywhere knowing that, one, the lobby to keep it open is going to be firing on all cylinders to keep it open?
Well, when you're a member of Congress, you're not powerless, even if you're a freshman. You, in large part, you have the ability to convene as well. You know, you can pick up the phone and call any reporter. You can pick up the phone and get community leaders together. You can commit, you know, you can educate. There are many ways, you know, you can, you know, you like you do anything in government or in politics, you bring people together and you move forward towards a goal. I'm not opposed to oil. I'm not opposed to pipelines. Pipelines are the safest way to move oil. We don't want oil on trains or trucks or, God forbid, barges. Our country needs to build more pipelines. But we have a 63-year-old pipeline in the Straits of Mackinac that hasn't been independently inspected. And we're being told this is safe by the very same people who were the responsible parties for the Kalamazoo River spill in 2010, the largest inland oil disaster in the history of America. And we're being told this is safe by the very same people who told us the Flint water was safe. Look, we need to shut this down. We need to independently inspect to make sure that it's safe independently. And then third, let's work with the governor's pipeline task force to find alternative pipeline routes. That's simple. And let's what? Let's build some more tight pipelines. You know, our country has increased our energy output by many fold over the last 20 years. That's a good thing. But the energy infrastructure has not kept pace, and that's a prescription for disaster. I don't want a pipeline through the Great Lakes. Let me just put it that way. If we were to build a new pipeline, let's keep it. Let's not just create a problem 50 years down the line. Let's build pipelines, but let's keep them out of our Great Lakes.
But are you saying that you see pipelines as the future of the Great Lakes and Michigan energy economy?
No, I'm saying that we have to move oil in this country. Oil's a big piece of our economy. It's got to be moved. We've got to move it safely, and pipelines are the way to do that. Let's build more pipelines, but let's not build them in the Great Lakes.
Let's hear from Ron from Traverse City on line one. Ron, you're on the air. What is your question for Lon?
Ron, my question is this. Especially, I had a real liking for Bart Stupak when he ran for the office for 17 years as he was elected. What is your opinion on what type of personality would have the most influence in Washington and best represent our aging population in northern Michigan?
Well, I think, thank you, sir. Thank you for calling this morning. I think Bart Stupak had that. For 18 years, he worked on a bipartisan basis or a nonpartisan basis to get things done for us. That is the best, I believe, posture, if you will, of what we need in a member of Congress. You know, look, we've got real challenges. We've got to protect what you've already earned, your Social Security, your Medicare, and your VA benefits. We've got to also build a northern Michigan where our families can stay and succeed. We do that by bringing high-speed internet and mobile cell phone service to every community, returning passenger rail service, getting a new Soo Lock. These are not things, both of those items, protecting what you've earned and building a new a northern Michigan where our families can stay and succeed. These are not Democrat or Republican items here. These are real problems that we face in northern Michigan. And if you approach it on a partisan basis, you'll never get anywhere. You have to work on a bipartisan basis, regardless of who controls the White House, regardless of who controls the Congress. You can't be a partisan firebrand and be effective. Bart Stupak was the model for that. And I'm proud that Bart Stupak has endorsed my campaign. I'm proud to have his endorsement.
We have a little less than 10 minutes left in this call-in hour with Lon Johnson. This is just a couple minutes left for you to call in right now to ask Lon a question before this election. The phone number is 800-681-5929. That's 800-681-5929. You brought up the Soo Locks. The Department of Homeland Security put out a report about a year ago. And basically expressing how important the locks are to the entire American manufacturing economy. Homeland Security in this report says that if there was a malfunction at the largest of the locks, the PO lock, mm-hmm. and a long outage there, you know, the result could be economic recession.
Yeah, 20% and above unemployment.
In Michigan. That's mm-hmm. higher than during the Great Recession. How can we prevent that from happening?
Well, again, it's about a member of Congress that's willing to take that report, dust off, you know, take it off the shelf, dust it off, and then build a consensus around the affected industries. And we've got to move beyond just the Michigan delegation. We've got to go to affected manufacturers and show them this is what would happen if this were to go down, and here's the real threat, here's the true condition of this lock, and we need your help. We need you to call your senator. We need you to call your member of Congress. We need you to call the White House. It's about building a team. This is not going to be a one-man show to get the lock funded. It was approved. It just hasn't been funded. So we need a member of Congress to go out there and create advocates. We already have the Michigan delegation. That's done. But we need to go and to go across party lines and go across geographic lines and get other members of Congress to make this a priority. And the way we do that is we engage private industry and show them the conditions and what would happen to their business. And we need you on the phone with your senators and members of Congress.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Jack Siegel. He's a retired diplomat and the chair of the International Affairs Forum. He's on line one. Jack. Hi, Jack. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. Thank you very much. Lon, I'd like you to talk a bit about your experience in Iraq, particularly what do you see as the solution for the United States? What role can the United States play in what's going on there now? I hear a lot about the military solutions, but you were working on the civilian side and have a good perspective on that.
Thanks, Jack. I think that we have a responsibility. Look, the biggest problem that I saw in Iraq is that we had when the Sunnis and Shiites, the divide was there was just too great, and still is. The Iraqi population have to overcome their tribal and religious differences, and they learn and need to learn how to cooperate and form a unified government to get things done. You're seeing this seesaw effect when the Shiites take over, they then are punitive towards the Sunnis, and when the Sunnis obviously were in power, they were punitive. Punitive is light. They were going out and killing each other. And we need, until such time that the Sunnis and Shiites and these tribal entities can get along, I think many of our other efforts won't bear as much fruit as we hope it would. We need to make sure that Sunnis and Shiites, we've created a unified government, and that is should be our one of our biggest priorities.
And so that should be a role of the American government.
Well, I think it should be a role of the Sunnis and the Shiites, frankly, you know, and other Arab nations. You know, it is important for the Sunnis and Shiites to want this themselves. And they have to be, you know, again, we have to use maybe a stick and a carrot approach to encourage that. But until such time that the Sunnis and Shiites can govern and live in a united way, I think many of our other efforts won't bear as much fruit as we'd hoped.
How do you judge the job that President Obama has done in Iraq?
This is very difficult. There's no easy solutions to this, to terrorism and to the Middle East. There are just none. You know, I believe that, you know, we have a, when we invaded Iraq, we unleashed many tribal differences, and we unleashed many of these religious differences, and without a structure to responsibly replace, what was a dictatorship. I'm not defending Saddam Hussein here. This man was a dictator, and he needed to go, and he posed a real threat to the region and to America, I believe. However, we have a responsibility to think about how do we replace and how do we what structures do we put in place to make sure that it doesn't devolve into a continued threat. And that's unfortunately what I think has happened. Iraq has devolved into chaos. And we have a responsibility to come up with, you know, first off, contain any threat so it's not a threat to the homeland, to the United States, but also to make sure that it's no longer that it doesn't destabilize the region.
Our time, unfortunately, is just about up. One last question, though: when you're making your pitch to voters, you know, what's your 30-second pitch for why voters should choose you this November?
You know, it's time. There's two ways to look at our government. We need to invest in us. We need to we've always led the world here. We led the world in mining and copper and iron ore. We led the world in fur trade. We led the world in lumber. All that was about our ancestors looking around and saying, what do we have? Well, we've got good land. We've got the Great Lakes. We've got good people. How do we invest in them to create a northern Michigan where our families can stay and succeed? We got to do that two ways. One, we need to protect what you've already earned, your Social Security, your Medicare, and your VA benefits. There are real threats on that. Second, we've got to invest in us to create a place where our families can stay and succeed. That means high-speed internet, mobile cell phone service, a new Sioux Lock, bringing back passenger rail service. We need to invest in us.
Lon Johnson, thank you for coming on.
Thank you.
And this has been special election coverage on IPR News Radio. Thank you to Lon Johnson for coming in this morning. Morgan Springer helped produce the show and ran the phones. Aaron Selvig was our engineer this hour. Peter Payette is executive producer. I'm David Castleman. And you're listening to Interlochen Public Radio, WICA Traverse City, 91.5 FM, WLMN, Manistee, Ludington, 89.7 FM, WHBP Harbor Springs Petoskey 90.1 FM. We are online at IPR News Radio, we are online at IPRnews.org. Be sure to tune in on Thursday morning. We're going to have Green Party congressional candidate Ellis Bull on. That'll be on that's 9 o'clock in the morning on Thursday. And don't forget to register to vote today if you haven't already. Today's your last chance to do that. It's just before 10 o'clock, and this is IPR News Radio. The Diane Rehm Show is next.